This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's president says a future U.S. administration has no choice but to return to the international agreements abandoned by the current government. The Secretary of State in the U.S. state of Georgia says he was pressured by Republican Senator Lindsey Graham to invalidate ballots legally cast in the presidential election. And a government delegation from Bahrain reportedly heads to Israel, the first such trip since the two sides signed a normalization deal in September. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the next U.S. administration has no choice but to change course and return to compliance of international agreements. Rouhani said the possible change in the U.S. foreign policy will provide an opportunity for lifting sanctions against Iran. Joe Biden, the declared winner by media of the U.S. presidential election, has vowed to rejoin the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. That's the accord incoming President Donald Trump abandoned in 2018 and impose tough sanctions on Iran. Rouhani called the Trump administration an outlaw that unleashed an economic war on Iran. However, he said Trump has failed to achieve his goals through his so-called maximum pressure campaign. Iran's government spokesman Ali Rabi warns of a crushing response to any hostile move by Washington. Following a report that U.S. President Donald Trump asked his top aides about striking Iran's nuclear facilities. Earlier, we discussed the matter in our news review program.
Iran's government spokesman has warned that his country will give a crushing response to any hostile move by the U.S. Ali Rabi made the comment in response to New York Times report that the U.S. President Donald Trump had asked top aides about striking Iran's nuclear facilities. Trump reportedly floated the idea last Thursday during a meeting with the U.S. Vice President, the Secretary of State, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, among others. They dissuaded Trump by warning him that an attack on Iran could escalate into a broader conflict in the last weeks of his presidency. And Trump has unleashed a campaign of threats and sanctions against Tehran since pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal back in May of 2018. And now joining us for this news review is Daniel Kovalik, a university lecturer and author out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Mr. Lajos Saz, the political commentator, joining us from San Juan. Hello, gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Daniel, we'll start there with you. Your thoughts on this story?
Well, it's quite concerning, of course. I mean, the thought that our president would even think about attacking Iran and its nuclear sites is quite frightening. I think anyone with any rationality would oppose that. I am happy that it appears that rational heads did prevail, and I hope that does not happen. I think we need to de-escalate with Iran and not escalate. And the fact that Trump even considered this move, is of great concern, certainly.
And Daniel, is this a sign of frustration that after 4 years, your Iran policy kind of came belly up in the last final days and 2 months before your lease is up? This is basically what you're willing to do.
Yes, I think that's part of it. I think Trump is frustrated that Iran has survived these, very draconian sanctions, survived these threats, survived the murder of their very popular general, Soleimani. But I also think it's, due to the election frustration. He wants to find a way to stay in office, and maybe he thought that starting a war was a way to do that. So I think there's a couple things happening here.
Thank you, Daniel. And Lajos, hello, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Lajos, give us, if you could, please, your initial thoughts on this.
Well, if Trump is considering the possibility seriously, that this is not like some thought that crossed his mind, like it has happened, I believe, before. For instance, he thought about invading Venezuela. His generals dissuaded him. Well, if this wasn't just any fleeting thought, but something more serious, I would think, my view would be that Israel is behind Tel Aviv. And through Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, good friend of Benjamin Netanyahu, there is his another good friend, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Friedman. Those are examples, of course. There will be pressure on the part of Israel for the U.S. to finish the job, for Trump to do so, before there is a change of a presidency, even though Trump may not consider it as such. But I'm sure that he already may be considering that's what's going to happen next year. So before he leaves the White House, try to destroy Iran's nuclear program. And in doing so, they'll destroy a large part probably of the Iranian industrial complex, energy complex, military complex. So that might be my view, that there are pressures from Tel Aviv. And that's the other thing, that let's say that Trump doesn't start it. But Netanyahu may do it in collaboration with Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia. They'll start something. And let us not forget that Israel also has nuclear weapons and the ballistic missiles and cruise missiles to reach Iran. And then, of course, out of solidarity with Israel, then the U.S. is going to join in with the full extent of its might. But these, of course, are speculations on my part. But I believe it could happen if indeed there is pressure from Tel Aviv. But of course, we don't know, because like the generals, Miley, Joint Chief, Chairman of Joint Chief of Staff, and apparently the Vice President and the Secretary of State, who are, by the way, very pro-Israel. I mean, the Vice President and the Secretary of State by being evangelical Christians. Well, they are right in the sense that if there is an attack against Iran, Iran is going to unleash a reprisal that is going to bring, going to turn the Middle East, set a fire there, and is going to probably involve Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, because of the bases, naval bases they are there, of the United States, Iraq, because of the American bases there, Syria, and probably Israel will take advantage to attack Syria and Lebanon, Hezbollah, and Russia is there too. So this could quickly become a world war. So, well, let's hope that doesn't happen. But it's a very dangerous situation.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Always a pleasure to have you both on. Daniel Kovalik there joining us out of Pennsylvania, and Lyle Shazi joining us from San Juan. And that's a wrap for this segment of your news review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. The Secretary of State in the U.S. state of Georgia says Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has urged him to find a way to toss out legal ballots cast in the recent presidential election.
Senator Graham applied for us to audit the envelopes and then throw out the ballots for counties who had the highest frequency error of signatures. And that I tried to, you know, help explain that that's because we did signature match, you couldn't tie the signatures back anymore, you know, to those ballots. We got off the call and I said I would circle back, and I talked to counsel and I get back to them, and we just decided the best action was not to, you know, get back and re-engage.
Irregularities.
Graham disputed those comments, saying he's only called for toughening voter ID laws. Post-election chaos in the U.S. continues amid President Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud. On Tuesday, he sacked the country's top cybersecurity official. Chris Krebs had confirmed that the presidential election was highly secure. Meanwhile, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has rejected the Trump campaign's lawsuit regarding election observation in the city of Philadelphia. The lawsuit was one of several suits the Trump campaign filed in key states where his Democratic rival Joe Biden was projected the winner. Colin Campbell says there are a lot of disturbing implications from the actions of U.S. President Donald Trump during the recent weeks.
Yeah, there's a guy who was a director in the Department of Homeland Security, and the president now got rid of him. This is the latest in a series of firings over the past week after his loss in the general presidential election of 2020, a much-anticipated election, and many would argue one of the most consequential elections in recent American history. So this is, some would say, is out of anger that he lost the election, and we do see Krebs as a very pivotal person in all of this, one who has defended the integrity of the election, as the president has alleged voter fraud, not just voter fraud, but rampant voter fraud across the nation, telling his supporters, many of whom made up about 70 million Americans, that there was voter fraud in various states, which is why he lost the election. There are a lot of disturbing implications from what the president is doing, and the response, or lack of response, rather, from Republicans is quite concerning, some would say, frankly, disturbing.
Peru's Congress has sworn in Francisco Sagasti as the country's interim president in a bid to defuse a crippling political crisis. The 76-year-old centrist politician has become the third Peruvian president in a week. The Latin American nation has been grappling with a political crisis since the ouster of President Martin Vizcarra by the Congress earlier this month. His removal triggered weeks of often violent protests, which left two young people dead. Vizcarra's successor, Manuel Merino, resigned on Sunday after just 5 days in office. The caretaker president will serve until July next year, with a new presidential election scheduled for April. Sagasti is yet to name his cabinet, but has said he's open to including ministers from Vizcarra's government. Well, the Bahraini government delegation is reportedly headed to Israel, the first such trip since the two sides normalized ties 2 months ago. According to a flight tracking website, a Bahraini flight took off from Manama Airport on Wednesday morning, bound for Tel Aviv. Bahrain's Foreign Minister Abdel Latif Al-Zayani is leading the delegation. U.S. President Donald Trump's Middle East envoy is also on the flight. Diplomats have said the Bahraini top diplomat is due to meet Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and visiting U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates signed U.S.-brokered normalization deals with Israel at the White House on September 15th. Palestinians have called the deals a stab in their back. Israel has carried out airstrikes on the Syrian capital, Damascus, killing three military personnel. The Israeli army said its warplanes targeted military sites belonging to resistance groups. Sources from the Syrian army said one serviceman was also injured during the aggression. Syrian media have reported that the country's air defenses intercepted a number of Israeli rockets, which were fired from the occupied Golan. Israel frequently targets military positions inside Syria, especially those of the resistance groups, which have played a key role in helping the Syrian army in its fight against terrorists. Political analyst Scott Bennett believes the Israeli air raids are a provocative declaration of war on Syria.
This is certainly a provocative declaration of war, as Israel and the Zionist regime has consistently done. It's always astounding that the world has shown such deaf ears to the cries of the children and the women who are slaughtered and left in the street or buried under the rubble of the Israeli rockets and munitions and fighter plane raids. But once again, we see the true colors of a murderous, savage regime that has no morality whatsoever, no decency and no restraint, but is instead trying to capitalize, I think, on some of the political instability in the West and build upon their stabbing in the back of President Trump and then turning towards a larger war agenda against Syria and these other areas as part of their Oded Anan plan. They've been doing this and planning this and exercising it since 2001, and this is just a stepping up of that.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has strongly condemned the Palestinian Authority's decision to restore its ties with the Israeli regime. Hamas denounced the move as a contradiction of all Palestinian values and principles and a violation of the historic agreement signed by Palestinian leaders in Beirut. It further described the PA's decision as a blow to efforts for creating national and strategic unity to counter the occupation and annexation of Palestinian lands. It said the move will give an excuse to justify Arab states' normalization with Israel. Hamas called on the PA to immediately withdraw the announcement and not wager on Joe Biden's projected victory in the U.S. presidential election. This comes after the Palestinian Authority said it will resume civil and security cooperation with Israel.
We received today an official letter from the Israeli regime announcing its commitment to sign agreements between Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization. In my opinion, this letter, some would consider what I'm saying as an exaggeration, but whoever reads history would understand the importance of this letter. This is the first letter to be sent in all of Netanyahu's era.
The PA official said Biden's election campaign has rejected the so-called deal of the century proposed by the Trump administration. The Palestinian Authority suspended security and civil cooperation with Israel in May after Tel Aviv announced plans to annex the Jordan Valley in the occupied West Bank. The PA urged that the move would make a two-state solution impossible. Israel has also withheld some $890 million in tax transfers from the Palestinian Authority. Employees of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees have staged a sit-in protest in the Gaza Strip to demand their full salaries. UNRWA has been struggling with financial problems after the U.S. decision in 2018 to halt funding the agency. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
UNRWA employees went on partial labor strike to slam the agency's failure to pay their salaries. UNRWA has announced that workers would only receive part of their salaries for November and December due to budget deficits. The UN agency provides education, health and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem al-Quds, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria and Jordan. More than 1.3 million Palestinians live in the Gaza Strip and rely on UNRWA aid to survive. With some 13,000 people on staff, UNRWA is the main employer after local authorities in the blockaded Gaza Strip, which is home to about 2 million people.
The decision to delay or pay partial salaries is a grave violation of the rights of employees. It will only increase the sufferings of the Palestinian refugees at home and abroad. This is an unprecedented situation and will have dire consequences, especially in the Gaza Strip.
UNRWA is suffering from a huge budget deficit that has forced it to cut back its services to Palestinian refugees in recent years, including the provision of urgent relief and emergencies. The Israeli regime has been campaigning to defund the UN agency in an attempt to end the refugees' right of return. The crisis worsened after U.S. President Donald Trump decided to cancel funding to UNRWA in 2018.
The U.S. funding for UNRWA stood about $360 million each year. So after the U.S. decision, UNRWA was forced to lay off 116 emergency employees. This is the worst budget deficit that we have been experiencing over the past years.
UNRWA is a United Nations agency established by the General Assembly decades ago and mandated to provide assistance and protection to Palestine refugees across West Asia. According to UNRWA, there are over 5 million registered Palestinian refugees.
This partial payment of salaries will have a big socio-economic impact on all UNRWA employees. All services to Palestinian refugees will be hampered because of the budget deficit, including health, education, and aid.
The plight of Palestinian refugees began in 1948 upon the creation of the Israeli regime on occupied Palestinian land.
Palestinian refugees say that UNRWA cuts will only deepen the suffering after more than 7 decades of displacement. Ashraf Sharan, Gaza.
Let's wrap for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana. Avicenna.
hard as me. Iranian notables, sources of global honor.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in this episode you'll get more familiar with the Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries AH, corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries AD. He was Saif Faraghani. Saif Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries AH were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Sa'di, and Hafez lived in that era. As we said, there is little known about the life and times of Saifuddin Abul Mahomed Muhammad Faraghani. Dr. Zabiullah Safa, who has edited his Divan or collection of poems, writes in the introduction, "Our whole information about him is restricted to the Divan of poems that has remained for us, as there is name or trace mentioned in the literary references and sources of this able poet. Although he had a high status, an expression of mystic concepts, and certainly has been one of the leaders of Khanqah, there is no trace of him in the Farsi books of the great figures of mysticism and Gnosticism." You heard that Saifuddin Abu Mahomed Muhammad Faraghani was born in Transoxiana and left his town, Farghane, for Asia Minor, current Turkey, in youth. He lived the rest of his life in Aksaray, a small town of the region. Dear listeners, you also heard that the Iranian society was so much chaotic due to the Mongol invasion that most of the literary figures and poets lived in fear and tried to survive. What one finds in the works of that era mirrors the pains and misery of people under the Mongol rule. The sufferings of masses were reflected as complaints in the works of poems and writers, or in the form of comedy and farce of poets such as Sa'di Shirazi and Obeid Zakani. There were three groups in the turbulent conditions of that era. The Fritz group was the laymen who didn't understand the causes of the existing conditions and just tolerated them. The second group consisted of politicians who had assimilated themselves with the rulers to preserve the worldly gains. But the third group comprised of responsible writers and men of letters who would either try to advise the ruling class or castigated them through satires and sarcasm. Most of the Iranian poets were among the critics of the Mongol rulers, who has in fact invaded the country and gained control of every affair through pillaging the resources of this vast land. Khajuye Kermani, who lived in late 8th century AH, depicted the circumstances of his era both directly and indirectly, Farsical language. He has beautifully described the situation of his era and the endless injustice of rulers, as well as the misery of the people, in an ode. خلق دیوانه و از مهنت دیوان دربند وین عجبتر که ز دیوان زر دیوان طلبند هر کجا سوخته ای بی سر و سامان یابند وجه سیم سرزان بی سر و سامان طلبند. People are mad and chained in demon's yoke. yet strange, as they seek gold from these folk. Once they get hold of a poor wretched man, they ask him to pay for the gold. What a joke! Ohadi Maraqi, the writer of the valuable book, Jam-e-Jam, has mentioned the facts of his era in the form of preaching and admonition. A deep look at his book shows the depth of the people's distress under the rulers, statesmen, and guards. He points to the prevalence of oppression and widespread addiction to wine and hashish in society. The most vitriolic social criticism of the Mongol rule in Iran can be found in the works of Khaja Nizamuddin Ubayd Zakani. He has lashed out at the miserable conditions of his time and introduced different social classes, especially the ruling class and politicians, in the format of interesting satires, sarcasms, and ironies. Critics believe that Ubayd seriously suffered from the anomalies of his era and lambasted the ruling system with his caustic comedies. In his book, Akhlaqul Ashraf, or Morals of Nobles, he has criticized the rulers of Mongol era very seriously. The very naming of the book is an irony of the ruler's disposition. He points to the corruption, hypocrisy, injustice, mendacity, and deception that were rampant in the ruling system. He vehemently blasts the Mongol rulers, especially Genghis Khan and Hulagu. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. There are many who may consider Canada to be a safe haven for immigrants wishing to start a new life there. Yet horrible things happening to the black community, the people of First Nation and non-white immigrants indicate a fact that although people can live there freely, they can never be equal to white Canadians. International rights organizations have reported an array of violations in Canada, including rights of Indigenous people, violence against Indigenous women and girls, children, immigration detention, mining industry abuses, and sexual orientation, as well as gender identity. Stay with us for a debate on that issue.
Canada has always been considered a safe haven for immigrants who come from across the world to start a new life in the Northern American country. But many believe that the terrible things that happen to the black community of Canada, the people of First Nation and non-white immigrants, suggest that although they can live freely in Canada, they can never be equal to white Canadians.
There's no systemic discrimination. There's no system in Quebec.
Thank God that we're different than the United States.
But experts believe that Canada has been actually founded on systemic discrimination, and the authorities' denial is part of the systemic racism. They say Canada's society has been made based on white supremacy. Systemic racism means normalizing racism. non-white Canadians say they face systemic racism on an almost daily basis.
This country was founded on systemic discrimination.
The Canadian government says that Canada is radically different from the U.S. when it comes to racism. But the truth is, both countries have been founded on stolen and colonized lands. Both countries have attempted genocide on indigenous people. And both countries have a dark history in slavery. And now, decades later, non-white and indigenous communities of Canada are still struggling with police brutality. This attitude has also resulted in an increase in the number of hate crimes against non-white population of Canada. Joyce Achakuan heard racist and degrading comments from healthcare workers at a hospital in Montreal only moments before her death in September. She was one of the thousands of women who faced maltreatment because of her ethnicity. Canada has been coming to terms with racial injustice suffered by its indigenous people in recent years. In 2019, a government inquiry found that Canada was complicit in, quote, race-based genocide against indigenous women. The report said indigenous women were 12 times more likely to be killed or disappear than other women in Canada. The inquiry said the cause was the deep-rooted colonialism and state inaction. It also found that persistent and deliberate human and indigenous rights violations and abuses are the root cause behind Canada's staggering rates of violence. The Canadian government has repeatedly pledged to address these issues. But to this day, the number of racially motivated abuses still continues to rise.
Well, we got a couple of guests from Canada to discuss this. Joining me will be chair of the Community Coalition Against the Racism in Hamilton, Ken Stone. We're joining us out of Hamilton, Ontario. We also have author and columnist Robert Fantina out of Kitchener, Ontario. Good to have both of you gentlemen on the show. Let's go to Ken. Major human rights organizations report serious rights violations in Canada. They include wide-ranging abuses against Indigenous people, the continued confinement of immigration detainees in jails, a prison law that does not rule out prolonged solitary confinement, the overseas operations of Canadian extractive companies, and on top of all of these, a growing number of Indigenous women and girls either going missing or being murdered. Can you educate us in more details about the human rights situation in Canada?
The Canadian government and the colonial empires that ran Canada before Confederation were based on a racist and capitalist colonization of North America in which Native people were considered as subhuman, and they were, from the very first contact, killed on the spot. They were ethnically cleansed. Sometimes they were captured and made as household slaves. Later they were marginalized. Sometimes they were pressed into becoming the foot soldiers of one empire, the French or the British, against the other. They were used as workers in the colonial fur trade empires. They were finally marginalized onto reservations with their lands taken away from them, their cultures destroyed. And what you see today is the result of 500 years of exploitation. It's not just Native people. As you correctly pointed out in the intro to this program, immigrants from all parts of the world have suffered racism in Canada. The Japanese were interned in World War II. The Chinese were subject to a head tax. The Sikhs were not prohibited to immigrate. The Jews were not given safe passage or allowed to come into the country to free Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. The Orange Order was founded. It was continued here to keep the Irish down. It goes on and on. Racism has played a large role in Canada because the powers that be use it to exploit various groups at the lowest wages they can and to turn groups against each other. And that's why we say that people who have suffered from racism need to unite with other people who have suffered from racism and discrimination and change this society fundamentally, right down to the roots of who holds power and why.
Right. Let me ask Robert this question. Robert, Indigenous women are 12 times more likely to be killed or disappeared than other women in Canada. And this is based on government inquiry last year that found Canada complicit in race-based genocide against Indigenous women. Where does this emanate from?
I think there are a couple of sources. One is that, as Mr. Stone said, Canada was based on, Canada is a colonial nation. It's occupying Indigenous people's lands and continues to and has for, of course, centuries. And that's this marginalization of the Indigenous women and men and children too is all part of that. Now, we have what's been referred to as missing white women syndrome. If a white woman goes missing, it's major news. Her picture is on all the news outlets. Tearful requests for her return are presented on the news program. However, if a non-white woman is missing, it's not the case, because society has said they aren't as important, that women of color are simply not equal to women to white women. And this is a long-standing tradition, that may not be the right word, but it's built into the fabric of the country, because the country was founded on the genocide of the people who lived here for centuries. And they've been pushed onto reservations, they've been marginalized, they live in terrible conditions, and this continues because it serves the needs of the white power structure. And until that changes, nothing else is going to change for the people who are suffering.
Right. Now, Ken, Robert says that Canada was founded on genocide. There are also some experts arguing that Canada was also founded on a systemic discrimination and white superiority. What's your opinion?
Absolutely. The people who founded what is now Canada, that is to say, the people who took over and colonized what is now Canada, the British and the French mainly, had the view, the British had the view that they had a white man's burden to lift up the native people and bring them up to the standard, their standards. Of course, they never did that. The French had the mission of civilization, the mission civilatrice, where they would bring the poor heathens into the Roman Catholic religion and teach them the right way. These were just the cover stories for their systemic racism. They had no intention of ever bringing these people into full participation in society. And in fact, in some cases, such as in Newfoundland, the British colonial government there participated in the extermination of the Beothuks, which is a shameful chapter in Canadian history. In Canadian society, right until this day, it's a class society, and the people who are at the top of the class are mainly white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant males, and they seek to maintain their domination through a system of policing, laws, jails, denial of opportunities for education, medical care, housing, and every other aspect of society you can think of to the people at the bottom, and who are largely native. But there's also people who are at the bottom who are of color, people who are black, new immigrants. They are all put through the mill. And it's a self-perpetuating system whereby the people at the top use the racism to turn white people against people of color and people of other ethnic origins and native people. And for years, for centuries, this has gone on. But there has been a growing anti-racist movement and a growing movement of solidarity with native people that is pulling together people from all these groups and demanding equality and justice and restorative justice for the native people, especially, who have lost their lands, their culture, their health, their dignity, who had their children taken away from them in the residential school system. A lot of their Canada, as you said, has made strides in the last number of years in trying to restore, have some kind of accounting and change. And we have to applaud the people who have done that, and the certain changes in government where they've paid out land claims, they've paid compensation for the residential schools, they've made apologies, they've had royal commissions without an end. Unfortunately, you could paper your house with all the recommendations from those piles and piles of royal commission reports that have never been implemented. Nonetheless, the struggle continues, and it's the duty of all Canadians, whatever color, to help to support the native people in their struggles, such as the one that's taking place just a few miles from where I'm sitting, where the 1492 Land Back Group is taking back a piece of land on which a developer wished to make a new subdivision. I had the pleasure of joining with a trade union delegation of Solidarity that went to see them and bring them supplies the other day. That's the kind of thing that Canadians have to do.
Right. Now, Robert, the Ottawa government is saying that Canada is radically different from the United States when it comes to racism. Do you agree? Could you kind of draw a comparison between the two?
Canada seems to paper it over a little bit more more carefully, but the racism is still there. This is seen in some of the statistics that you mentioned earlier regarding the disappearances and deaths of Indigenous women. Also, the United Nations Proclamation on the Rights of Indigenous People was passed, and earlier this year, a bill was introduced into the Canadian Parliament to bring standards up to that, and it did not pass. So this is, again, where an attempt was made to try to bring things more equal, try to end the racism, and it failed, which is something that one would expect in the United States. But Canada has this image of not being racist. But we look at the same kinds of situations. We look at the number of non-whites who are in solitary confinement. We look at the number of immigrants who are caged. In the U.S. for a time, that was there was outrage against that, but that passed. It's old news, but it's still happening. But it continues to happen. It happens also, perhaps to a lesser degree, but also in Canada. There's other systemic racism. It is part and parcel of the establishment of the nation of Canada, the same way it was part of the establishment of the nation of the United States. It's endemic in its society and in its makeup, and changing it is not going to be easy, but it must be done.
Right. Canada government, as you know, has repeatedly promised to deal with such issues that we're talking about. It's also placed the long-awaited national inquiry on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, but it has failed to do so. Why is that the case?
It's not a priority for the government. Mr. Fantino said in previous comment, the Canadian government doesn't live up to its international obligations concerning Indigenous peoples, and it doesn't live up to even its own promises of what it will do to help Native people in Canada. And one of those is the missing and murdered Indigenous women. The commission has gone on for years. I don't see any radical changes about to take place, and I'm afraid probably that any recommendations will probably end up on the shelf gathering dust along with the other royal commissions that have taken place over the last 40 or 50 years. So I think that it's up to ordinary Canadians to take a stand here, to become active in their communities, and to take a positive role in fighting racism. I think that, in fact, that's the only way that things change in Canada, is when there's a grassroots pressure on the government to do something. For example, in this particular, in the case of pipelines, when the government wanted to put a pipeline through the Wet'suwet'en lands, and people took to the streets, and people blocked roads, people blocked highways and railway tracks.
Right.
That forces the government to come to terms. And even now in Caledonia, just a few miles from here, where the 1492 Land Bank has been holding out for a couple of months now, despite arrests, being shot at with rubber bullets, being beaten by police, they're holding out. And now there's talk that the federal and provincial governments may sit down to negotiate something, which is something they should have done at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they never even bothered to consult the traditional leadership of the Haudenosaunee people, that is to say, the leadership, the traditional chiefs of the Six Nations,
right,
who have been sitting on the, you know, brought into Canada and settled here as a result of the American Revolutionary War around 1784. So they've been here over 200 years on that land, and that land has been taken away from them progressively, year chunk by chunk, year by year. Now they want some of it back, and they're going to get it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Robert, Canada is also continuously exporting military equipment and weapons to countries with a record of human rights violations. Can you tell us something about this?
Yes, this is another violation of human rights that's a stain on Canada's record. Canada does export weapons, does sell weapons to anyone who wants to buy them. And this is in the U.S. model, certainly. It's certainly lucrative for the government, and it brings in quite a bit of revenue, but it is still in violation of international law. These other countries should not be receiving weapons unless and until they can bring their human rights practices up to at least a minimum standard, which they don't do. The Canadian government must immediately stop these sales. It's a violation of human rights within Canada because it violates Canadian law, but also it fosters the violation of human rights by these other countries. They continue to oppress their people, to kill their people and other people. So it's as if Canada is pulling the trigger and dropping the bombs themselves by providing this weaponry. This is another thing that needs to stop, and that is the Canadian government seems to hide sometimes. It's not clearly recognized how much weaponry that Canada does sell to other countries and who it sells it to. But if this were known, Canada would lose its undeserved reputation as a peacemaker and as a country that fosters diplomacy and justice. These are myths, unfortunately, that the government has fostered, but the reality is simply not the case.
Okay, on that note, we'll come to the end of this debate. Let me thank our guests. We had Chair of the Community Coalition Against Racism in Hamilton, Ken Stone, who joined us from Hamilton, Ontario, and author and journalist Robert Fantina out of Kitchener, Ontario. I've been your host, Behrouz Najaf.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him,
الجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gates of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. We are of course discussing about the qualities of the pious people, and our discussions are based on the sermon of the pious people or the Khutbatul Muttaqeen, which is one of the important sermons in Nahjul Balagha. It is also the 184th sermon in this powerful and monumental book, whose author is Imam Ali alayhi salam himself. Of course, he did not write it. He spoke, and all these words were collected by one of the great scholars of Islam, Sayyid Radhi. In this particular episode, we are going to discuss about a certain important quality of a pious person, and that quality is that his hopes are very realistic, they are very close by, and they are near, they are not far-fetched. They are nearby, where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Tarahu qariban amaluhu," and then of course he goes on and explains other things which we'll come to next time. Here Imam Ali alayhi salam says that if you want to see a pious person, then you will see that his hopes are realistic and nearby.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, as I said, one of the very dangerous things that Islam extremely discourages is the issue of having long hopes. Okay, we have got very many narrations regarding this issue. One of the most feared things that the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam had regarding his ummah is the issue of long hopes, وَطُولُ amal. The tulul amal is that issue that is very much discouraged and can be dangerous, as I mentioned previously. Now, we would like to see that according to the Quran, there are various verses that indicate that having long hopes is not good at all, and one of the reasons why many communities got destroyed in their of course in different phases of their existences because of this very reason, because of the fact that they were not very careful about controlling their hopes and aims and having long hopes without actions. If you look at for example one of the verses of the Quran, surah number 26, verse number 128 and 129, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that one of the prophets was talking to this community of Ad and telling them that you people are making big houses and firm fortresses and all of these things. Why? You are doing this because you want to stay forever. Now this is a long hope. It is an unachievable hope. You want to live in this world. It's an unrealistic hope. This world is temporary at the end of the day. You will die whether we like it or not. So building a strong house, building all of these things with the aim of living forever is a hope which is futile. There are many other examples, inshallah, that we shall come to.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when it comes to long hopes and far-fetched hopes, one of those hopes, of course, is to hope to live forever. Or, for example, in history we had people, scientists, who wasted their efforts looking for something called the elixir. Elixir is something that converts metals into gold, according to them. How many scientists spent years and years looking for this elixir? Well, it is not possible to have an elixir. I don't know where science has achieved today, but it is something that is, to have a liquid that can transform, for example, a metal into gold. I think that liquid itself will end up to be more expensive than all the gold in the world, probably, because it will be a very powerful chemical. So, I don't know, they spent years and years looking for this chemical and they wasted so much energy. And you've got various examples. People who look to scientifically teleport people in time. Okay, and things like that. These are issues that make a person have long and unrealistic hopes that waste their energies and time rather than looking for what is correct, what is nearby. A person who is a truthful person, a pious person, is one whose hopes are nearby. His hopes are not far. His hopes are realistic. Because a pious person contemplates inside his soul and he sees that the true aim in life is to achieve goodness, purity, spirituality, and closeness to God. These are his aims. And these aims are completely realistic. They are achievable. He doesn't find it far. Even these spiritual aims and objectives can become far hopes, far-fetched hopes or long hopes if a person does not take steps. There was a person, for example, who used to tell me that I want to become a scholar who purifies others. When people would look at his actions, they would see, oh my God, his actions are quite weak and he doesn't take really important steps to be able to be a scholar who purifies others, who brings others to spirituality. So even these spiritual aims, if a person wants to have in life, he should have definitely, but he will be unfortunately thrown into the quagmire of long hopes if he will be not taking the right steps practically to be achieving those goals. And because a pious person is always looking for steps, is always taking those steps, he's always his hopes are realistic, true, and they are nearby and achievable. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that he gives us the opportunity to have such hopes that are good and are nearby and are realistic. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب مرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Around the World with Reporters.
With Christmas right around the corner.